The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the third in this series of 15 literary dialogues on love, human and divine, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren.
Maurice, we are discussing this summer human and divine love as we find it evidenced powerfully and deeply and better than anywhere else in the Hebrew Bible. The first time, we talked about God's love of man. Then, last week, we talked about man's love of God. And I indicated at a certain moment that I was anticipating today's topic, which is man's love of man, when I spoke of something that perhaps is not material now, except that it did introduce the topic. I have been a little troubled by an agreement that we reached perhaps prematurely upon one point, when we said that those who retired from the world or withdrew from the world in order to love God perfectly, hermits of any sort, or people of any sort, as I say, who make a profession of loving God in seclusion, perhaps we agreed prematurely that those persons, in all cases at any rate, had substituted a means for an end, had lost sight of the original purpose. I think it was not difficult for us to understand each other when we said that perhaps the noblest form of that kind of love would be a love conducted in the world, even though a kind of solitude was found in the soul wherein the exercise could be carried on. I've been thinking since not only of persons who for religious reasons in connection with religious duties and orders retire from the world, and there have every right to say, as they often do, that they have not literally retired. They are thinking about the world with an intensity that most people don't think about
when they're in it. There are many of them who believe that great prayer, concentration on prayer, serves the world.
Yes, that's right.
That's true, I think, in all religions, or in many religions.
That's right. They are constantly praying for the world, and therefore are in it in a true sense. But it's also true, isn't it, that a man, a secular man, a scholar who retires to write a book, it may take him 5 years to finish it, and who seems to be doing nothing else than that, may be very well justified in doing it, although he also could become fanatical and become blind to what his book should mean to everybody, and we know that that can happen. There are books of pedantry that are the result of this kind of research. I merely wanted to point out that we perhaps had not recognize the shade of truth that there is.
These are enormous subjects. The question of withdrawal from the world and serving the world, the interrelation between the two, there is one. One may withdraw for a time just in order to think things over or to discipline oneself or to get a perspective. And what I had in mind when I spoke about it is the extreme type. And there are such extreme types everywhere who say, I'm through with the world. And they say, farewell, proud world, I'm going home. Not when they're dying, but I'm through with you.
Yes.
There are such types, and I think that is contrary to the spirit of true religion everywhere and in every religion. It has been carried to extremes among Buddhists who say at the age of 60, 65, say, well, I'm through. I take my beggar's bowl. I have no concern with the world, although they have, apparently, because they go out with a beggar's bowl. Among Jews, there has been the type of temporary withdrawal that is called taking the exile upon oneself. In Yiddish, you say, golus oprichten. I take exile upon myself. A man leaves his home, goes into the world at large with nothing at all except what people will give him, and learns what it is to eat the bread of charity and to climb what was it that, how was it that Dante put it, how steep are the stairs that lead to other men's homes and how salt is the bread of charity. Yeah. And, of course, to be able to do that without rancor against anybody, not to feel yourself humiliated, to accept that position with grace, is in itself a considerable achievement. And if it's done for a time as a discipline and in order to bring one closer to the world, actually, rather than to make oneself remoter from it, then that is a creative act.
Yes, and in order, Maurice, to bring back to the world, when one returns to it, to bring back to it something priceless, something that perhaps could not have been produced, could not have been shaped and perfected in busy hours.
That, however, should be the occupation and preoccupation of extraordinary men. There's a saying in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, thou shalt not separate thyself from the congregation. It isn't meant specifically in this sense. It isn't meant as a specific warning against the kind of withdrawal we're talking about. It is meant that a man should participate in the joys and sorrows of the congregation and be part of it. But for the large mass of human beings, such withdrawal is probably unnatural. It may be the result of some temporary upset and not a thing to be encouraged, and perhaps sometimes not even to be condoned. Go and mingle with your fellow men is the healthy attitude.
Well, now, Maurice, that we are free to proceed, having made that reservation, we have the topic before us of man's love of man, a very famous topic, one that can be discussed superficially or profoundly. There are sentimental aspects of it that I dare say we shall have very little sympathy with. I raised the question last week whether ultimately man's love of man is a real thing and a true thing unless it has somehow or other in the background of it, unless it has the shadow upon it of God's love of man and man's love of God. Do you agree that there is a real relation?
That there's an interplay, yes. One might even go so far as to say that, as some have done, that love of God is expressed almost exclusively through love of man. You remember Coleridge's line, he prayeth best who loveth best all things, both great and small. But going back to what we were talking of 2 weeks ago, the first of our talks, and again, the commandment. There's a commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. And then the repeated commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself.
Yes.
This has been a stumbling block to me in my attempts to visualize its actual application. Thy neighbor as thyself means all other human beings. You should love them as you love yourself, without discrimination, so that it's a sin to dislike anybody.
You're not assuming then that the word neighbor merely means the man next door.
No, chaver is the Hebrew word. It means your companion.
Yes.
The person outside of you.
Yes, any person outside of you.
Yes.
Wherever he may be. Well, you know, the one reason that this is difficult, perhaps, or that, well, I can conceive of two reasons why it's difficult to understand. There's a reference to love of thyself, love thy neighbor as thyself. That, of course, it needs to mean no more than this, that you put the same value upon anyone else that you put upon yourself, that you insist upon paying to anyone else the same respect that you pay for yourself. You do not dismiss anyone else as somehow outside.
Yeah, but suppose a man loves himself egotistically and exhibitionistically and selfishly, so that the love he transfers to another is to make that person exhibitionistic and selfish.
Well,
as thyself, I don't suppose they meant that you must love him with all of the egotisms that you have for yourself.
No, but love of self does not necessarily need to mean that kind of love.
Not necessarily.
Well, I take it that it doesn't.
There are such loves.
Oh, of course there are. Just as there can be perversions and of anything, but true love of self, it seems to me, is merely that kind of willingness to accept oneself and begin with oneself as the true beginning, past which or beyond which you can go on to other love. A person who cannot love himself cannot love others. I have seen that.
That's a pregnant remark. If a man dislikes himself, It's no good telling him that he must love other people.
That's right. He doesn't know how.
But that this thing is very complicated is evident from a simple story that I'm sure you're familiar with. The great Hillel, the great sage who lived at the turn of the common era, was an example of infinite patience and forbearance. And there once came to him a heathen who said, "I want you to teach me the whole of the Jewish law idiom was, while I stand on one leg," meaning in a single phrase. And Hillel said, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That is the whole of the law. The rest is commentary. Now go forth and learn."
Yes.
Now, going forth and learning means acquiring all the knowledge that there is concerning relations between human beings. So to say, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself is only the beginning of a long examination as to what implications are there.
Well, now, you're quite right in underlining this. The second difficulty that I had, because I spoke of two, the second difficulty might be this. The difficulty of understanding the difference between loving all men, as, say, reformers love all men, or men who want to save the world to love all men, and the way one man can love another. It has often been pointed out that lovers of mankind are cold at heart.
Let's take an extreme instance.
In other words, they don't love any individual man, but they love man.
Yes, let's take an extreme instance. Say Karl Marx.
Yes.
Now, Karl Marx, I presume, acted out of love of mankind.
I suppose
one presumes that, given the benefit of the doubt. But he was, in his personal relations, a very nasty person. The things he said about various people, about Bakunin, who is on the extreme leftist, about capitalists, about the Jews, by the way. He wrote with such venom and with such an enjoyment of his venom that you ask yourself, can a man who is predominantly hateful, meaning thereby full of hate toward individuals, actually be motivated by the love of the species? And, of course, it's not so easy to answer.
Well, you may remember Jonathan Swift, the author of Gulliver's Travels, a very curious kind of man, to be sure, but a genius, once said that he had no difficulty in loving Tom, Dick, and Harry. Those were not the names he used. I've forgotten what they were, but we used those three names. In other words, he tended to love any individual that he knew, but he could not love that animal called man. Whereas the professional lover of mankind seems to confine his love to the species, as you say, to man in general, whereas we find him oftentimes in his relations to individuals singularly without feeling, singularly cool and remote. The great thing would be to be able to do both.
There's a charming passage somewhere in Sholem Aleichem about anti-Semites and so-called anti-Semites. You'll find some anti-Semites who hate the Jewish people. Then you say to him, "But do you hate that fellow Yankel?" He said, "Oh, no, Yankel's a very nice fellow.
Yes.
He's all right. Do you hate Shmuel over there?" "No, he's a very decent fellow, that fellow Shmuel. He has it in his mind that he hates the Jewish people for some fault in his upbringing or because of some folkloristic effect upon him, but actually he doesn't dislike anybody."
That's right.
But there are other types who love the Jewish people, but when you ask them individually, "What about so-and-so?" "That fellow, that no goodnik, and so-and-so, why, he's not worth the ground he walks on." There are these curious inversions.
Well, by the way, the first type of man is the preferable type.
Oh, yes, because with him it's a fault, certainly, that there's a quirk in his mind, but actually there isn't in him venom, the hatred. It's just some sort of complex that has to do with ideas. But, Mark, let me get back to that terrible problem that we're both wondering about. The love, the indiscriminate love of all. Actually, a person who loves everybody that he meets. While I was thinking over the material for these talks, I remembered a character that I'm sure you're familiar with, Platon Karatayev in War and Peace.
Oh, yeah.
He appears just quite incidentally but in a marvelous vignette in which Tolstoy showed his moral genius. He was a great moral genius as well as a great artist. He gives us the picture of that kind of man and raises the problems that are troubling us just now. I'd like to read just a short excerpt which I took down for the purpose of these talks.
I wish you would.
You remember the character of Pierre Bezukhov? He's one of the main characters.
Oh, yes.
Toward the latter part, toward the end of the book, Pierre is in Moscow after the fire. He's been arrested on suspicion of having taken part. He's thrown in with a great number of Russians, mostly simple, poor people. He himself belongs to the aristocracy. Thrown into a huge barracks where they're maltreated by the French. And he comes across a little figure. This is how Tolstoy describes it. Close by Pierre, a little man was sitting bent up, of whose presence Pierre was first aware from the strong smell of sweat that rose at every movement he made. This man was doing something with his feet in the darkness, and although Pierre did not see his face, he was aware that he was continually glancing at him. Pierre was conscious of something pleasant, soothing, and rounded off in the deft movements and even in the very smell of the man, and he did not take his eyes off him. "And you have seen a lot of trouble, sir, eh?" said the little man suddenly. And there was a tone of such friendliness and simplicity in the sing-song voice that Pierre wanted to answer, but his jaw quivered, and he felt the tears rising. At the same second, leaving no time for Pierre's embarrassment to appear, the little man said in the same pleasant voice, "Aye, darling, don't grieve, dearie." He said it in that tender, caressing sing-song in which old Russian peasant women talk. "Don't grieve, dearie. Trouble lasts an hour, but life lasts forever. Aye, aye, my dear. And we get on very finely, thank God. Nothing to vex us. They are men, too, and good and bad among them." These were all misty figures to Pierre afterwards, but Platon Karatayev remained forever in his mind the strongest and most precious memory, the personification of everything Russian, kindly, and round. And then Tolstoy goes on to describe Karatayev. Attachments, friendships, love, as Pierre understood them, Karatayev had none. But he loved and lived on affectionate terms with every creature with whom he was thrown in life, and especially so with man. Not any particular man, but with a man who happened to be before his eyes. He loved his dog, loved his comrades, loved the French, loved Pierre, who was his neighbor. But Pierre felt that in spite of his affectionate tenderness to him, in which he involuntarily paid tribute to Pierre's spiritual life, Karatayev would not suffer a moment's grief at parting with him. And Pierre began to have the same feeling towards Karatayev. Now, marvelous thing. Yet, how many human beings are capable of foregoing a desire for some discrimination? That I want to be liked a little more by you than you like. You can like everybody, but like me a little bit more.
That's well, now, human more here you are using the word like.
Well, even love.
Yes, I know, but remember, last week we endeavored to distinguish between liking and loving. And inevitably, we slipped back and forth between those terms. This little man next to Pierre, Pierre had thought of as a little man who loved him, Pierre, only because Pierre happened to be there at that moment. The next fellow who took his place would be liked or loved just the same. I quite agree with you that there is no escape from the conclusion that ultimately we love individuals whom we prefer. There are certain individuals, well, we don't love them perhaps any more than we love other men, but we like them better than we like other men. We like to be with them. We like the way they talk. We like the way they look. As a matter of fact, we never know why we like them so much, because surely one of the great mysteries in life is why A likes B.
Yes.
We shall never discover why.
No, they look at it psychoanalytically and psychologically and whatnot, but I suppose it's beyond reach, and I suppose it's best it should remain so. The remember Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem that she didn't want to be loved for any particular reason.
Yeah.
Don't say that you love me for a trick of my look or for some particular gift, but just for no reason whatsoever. And,
Well, of course, that's right. I can understand that. Can't you? Very well,
yes,
indeed.
Yes, because they call that in Hebrew, Ahava Shalot Luya Badavar, love that is not dependent upon anything whatsoever. It simply comes as itself and manifests itself, and is supposed to be, of course, the most enduring kind of love.
Now, Maurice, this reminds me that you and I have sometimes disagreed about this, namely that friends, good friends, that is to say men who love one another, and this it could apply to men and women too, can afford to be frank to one another in naming one another's faults. And to be sure, the book of Proverbs has a marvelous couplet that I happened to chance upon just the other day. The 27th book of Proverbs, in the 17th verse, says, "Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend." And there are many proverbs which suggest that, which counsel the friend to be frank in censuring his friend.
Yes, yes. Now, in Proverbs 2, you have the open rebuke is better than
hidden love.
Than hidden love. Or in Leviticus, we're told specifically, "Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thy heart. Thou shalt surely rebuke thy neighbor and not bear sin because of him."
Yes. But you know, this is complicated, too. This isn't too easy to live out. My observation is that whenever, now, I'll be quite frank, I'll be very personal. Whenever a friend of mine has pointed out a fault that seemed to me to be a searching fault, I mean a fundamental one, I was hurt.
You were hurt. Well,
all right.
No,
but it made a very serious difference.
Would change your attitude toward him?
You see,
For a time?
For a time. You see, I'm quite willing to agree that we should have our faults pointed out to us, and yet perhaps we don't really think we have any fundamental ones at any rate. And yes. And the trouble, you see, yes. what fault is more fundamental than what other fault? Something could be pointed out that seems quite trivial, and yet our vanity makes our minds race ahead and abstract that little.
Isn't there a way
that little fault until it becomes a huge one?
Isn't there a way in which that could be done? Here, there's a passage in Proverbs, which puzzles me, bearing on this. He says, "Love covereth all sins." Does he mean by that if you love a person, you cover all the sins and you don't observe them? Or does it mean that you observe them and tell about them? Is it perhaps that we don't know how to tell somebody his faults? Is it perhaps that every one of us rejoices a little bit to be able to correct somebody else, and this feeling of triumph superiority is what makes our hackles rise?
Yes, but maybe true love or true friendship is based upon a blindness to the faults of the object of love. Maybe what we mean when we say that so-and-so loves someone else is that he does not see his faults. Everyone else can see his faults. The policeman can see his faults. Yes. The census taker can see his faults. People who are indifferent to him can see his faults. But A does not see the fault of B, and that's what we mean when we say that A loves B. Now, to be sure, from time to time, just in a kidding way, he may josh his friend and say, "Oh, listen, you're crazy, or you don't understand
well,
this." But that must be said in a certain way, or it pulls the rug out from under the other man.
Well, again, the very wise book, Proverbs, you have this observation: "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." Now, he uses the word wounds. In other words, you're supposed to be hurt by it. Mm-hmm. And your amour propre is outraged. And you think to yourself, perhaps, he would see that in me, wouldn't he? And he has to remark on it.
All I'm trying to say is that you had better be careful.
Well, the point is that the problem is too complicated, really. It needs several lifetimes of study as to what the various passages in the Bible mean. Not that they have to all be in harmony with each other. You can have opposite advice, as you have in Proverbs sometimes. It says, "Answer a fool according to his folly," and then the opposite, Do not answer a fool according to his folly.
Yes, but now, for instance, the Proverbs are inconsistent with respect to this. One, in the 17th book, the 9th, says, "He that covereth a transgression," and I think covereth means ignores or pulls a veil over.
Yes, it does. Yes.
"He that covereth a transgression seeketh love," that is to say, promoteth love. But yes, "he that separateth," that repeateth the matter, "separateth even friends." Now that might be that might refer to things we say about what other people have done. The lover of someone tends to ignore and tends not to talk about his fault.
Well, I think that "he that repeateth a matter," using the word "repeateth" there, I think he means nags.
Yes.
If you nag a person about his faults. But I would accept your interpretation. "He that covereth a transgression seeketh love." But is it commended? Are you supposed to... Well, it's a form of flattery almost, isn't it? Well, you might even go so far to call it toadying, that you ignore, you cover the transgression, you are aware of it. It's not that you don't see it. It's not what you implied before, that you don't see the faults of the person. You do see it, and you ignore it, and perhaps it's not to the advantage of your friend that you should ignore it. You should be worrying about it. This is what God's love is, by the way. God's always worrying about the faults in people.
Yes.
And he wants to correct them. And that is why we're afraid of him. That is why his love is oppressive, because he won't let us get away with nonsense and with saying, "Oh, now you're a nice God. Why don't you forget all about this? Why do you keep nagging me about behaving? Be a good fellow."
Yes, and yet, Maurice, there is the wonderful relation between David and God in the books of Samuel in the Hebrew Bible. David does many things of which God disapproves and for some of which he punishes David. And yet God, certain all the time of David's love for him, is able to forgive him and to understand him. The knowledge that David loves him somehow makes all the difference. Yes, of course, there's an acute observation of David's flaws and of David's defects and even of his sins.
Now, Mark, we've got onto a subject that might absorb very well the rest of our talks. And I suppose we'll have to leave this and move on. We want to talk next week about love of man for man and man for woman in the more general sense. And I'd like to begin next week's talk with the question of love being the only guiding principle in life, as to whether that is a valid view, it has often been advocated, or whether the people who call it antinomianism are right and that it is not a valid principle.
Just heard "The Words We Live By," the third in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of love, human and divine. "The Words We Live By" is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
Next, monitor news on the hour on NBC Radio.